Welcome to the Bailiwick Express podcast. This is The Interview, one in a series of podcasts where we at the Bailiwick Express speak to members of our community about events, personal stories, politics, current events or charitable initiatives. Thank you for joining us.
For many parents, the birth of a child is a magical, miraculous occasion, which is memorable for what went right. There are many cases, though, where the parents can be left traumatised over what happens for multiple reasons. And those reasons aren't always clear. Former midwife Laura Spence is Guernsey's first birth trauma support coordinator. She can help those affected navigate their feelings. Alongside her work at Bright Beginnings, Laura's also now working with the Prio Premature Baby Foundation as it comes into contact with many people at risk of experiencing birth trauma. But Laura says the reasons for the birth trauma are not always that clear.
I was offered a position at Bright Beginnings Universal Children's Centre they already offer a fabulous range of support services for parents and families from conception right the way through till the child will start school. And sort of within that, there's a real focus on mental health for both parents, and a focus on child development and establishing really strong parent-infant bonds is a really good foundation. We're becoming more and more aware of the impact of the birthing experience and the lasting effects that that can have on people. It is rapidly making its way up the political agenda in the UK. Quite recently, there's been a public inquiry by the UK government around why people are experiencing such traumatic events during birth. And actually, when we talk about birth trauma, it kind of, the title of birth trauma kind of leads you to believe that it might have been, you know, something physical that happened during birth. But actually, it covers a whole range of things. It can be something that precedes your pregnancy, like if you've had a loss at an early stage, if you've had to have a termination for whatever reason that might have been. Reproductive grief in terms of if you're requiring, you know, assistance to get pregnant in the first place. And then once you are pregnant, things like hyperemesis, so extreme pregnancy sickness, and you know, there's huge things that can impact that you bring with you into pregnancy. And essentially, my job at Bright Beginnings was to thread the theme of birth trauma and raise awareness of, you know, the sort of prevalence of it and make sure that we're catering to the needs of those parents across a whole range of things.
And as you said, birth trauma can be something that could far precede this pregnancy, this labour and birth.
Precisely.
I'm guessing it will also go on for a long time after.
Absolutely.
Just because you give birth and you have, hopefully, have the baby in your arms afterwards, that doesn't mean the end of the trauma, I'm guessing.
No, absolutely. And the thing is, you know, we need to be considering the trauma that people have had across the course of their life, because obviously looking at adverse childhood experiences is a massive thing that can, you know, there are certain risks or certain things that have happened to people throughout the course of their lives before they get to the point of conception and then journeying into parenthood that they're bringing with them, and many of those things make them a little bit more vulnerable to sort of poor mental health during pregnancy and subsequently child birthing. And it might be particularly triggering for some people, you know, going through various things. There's a wealth of risk factors. And I think historically, lots of women in particular have, by default of the society that we live in, been forced into this narrative of, that's just what happens in childbirth, you know, put on your big girl pants and get over it, you've got a healthy baby and that's it. You should be grateful for that. and then we don't, it's unspoken. And actually that very much shouldn't be the narrative anymore. Mm. It's, you know, we care about the things that have happened to you in your life, and if we want to be improving mental health outcomes, child development, and just general well-being of people, we need to be more considerate around those narratives and validate the experiences that people are having.
You referenced their healthy babies, and actually I may have naively thought birth trauma is around where the baby isn't healthy, either a stillbirth or another fatal situation, or a premature baby, or a baby who for whatever reason needs neonatal care, I think is the phrase. But actually, you said they're healthy babies. And actually, we do think, don't we? If you've got a healthy baby, that's the goal, isn't
it? Yes, yeah.
But there can still be trauma attached, even if the baby
absolutely,
is perfectly
100%.
Healthy.
And I think that's, you know, that surprises people sometimes, and probably feeds into that narrative again around you know, your own internal narrative, that you're having those conversations with yourself. I should be grateful for that I've got a healthy baby, so why do I feel like this? But you know, a lot of us do, and you might experience, you know, for historically me as a midwife, I might have looked at someone's notes and thought, oh, that just all seems very straightforward to me. But it's all about how it's perceived and how they've felt in that situation, what the communication was like, you know, what were the circumstances round about that birth, how did they internally feel? Because even though, you know, on the whole they might feel that it was a really positive experience, if they felt scared, out of control, if they felt as if they were going to die, any of those things can sort of just play into it and leave some lasting trauma. And you know, you don't always necessarily recognise it at the time, because you're very kind of task focused, you're living feed to feed, nap to nap, changing the nappies, you're one foot in front of the other, just trying to get yourself through those very challenging early days. But the fact of the matter is, at some point it might, you know, and that might be in a year's time, 2 years' time, it might be the reason that some people put off having more children. It might be not until they then become pregnant again that they realise, oh my God, I feel a sense of dread at the thought of having to go through that again. And there's no, you know, there's, I don't want this to come across as the fault of anybody. It's just by nature of the beast, if you like. It's sometimes completely unavoidable, because it's about how we feel. You know, it's how the lasting feelings that you're taking with you. And of course, as I said before, there are certain risk factors. For example, someone who may have been struggling with their mental health previously and then obviously goes on to have children, it may make them more at risk of suffering symptoms of kind of, I suppose, PTSD is. Not everybody will go on to have it's only a small percentage of people that could be clinically diagnosed with PTSD, but certainly you can experience a lot of the symptoms without meeting the threshold for a formal diagnosis. So yeah, I guess a lot of the work that we're doing at the minute in Bright Beginnings is around getting rid of that stigma that you...
It's okay to talk about it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it's normal, you know, not... It's hard work having children, especially when there are things that have happened to you in your life that are compromising how you feel about yourself and how you perceive the world around about you.
Is any data collated on birth trauma? Do we know how many mothers, and you mentioned both parents earlier.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say
how many
that.
Parents and families actually are affected by birth trauma?
If we think about it in terms of mental health, I think the statistic is one in four mothers. And by the data that has been collected for fathers, one in ten. However, that statistic is probably far more. That's just the fathers that have spoken about it. And so we know that historically men, you know, don't favour speaking so openly about their mental health. There is some research around the rate of suicide in males, for example. Suicide is the leading cause of death for males under the age of 50.
Yeah.
And during that perinatal period, they're 47 times more likely, you know, to be having those suicidal ideations. Wow. And, you know, obviously the statistics for mum, we know from the most recent Embrace report, which is kind of data that's collected across a period of 3 years, anyone, you know, into one report around why mothers are dying in childbirth. Mm. And for the second time in a row, so over the course of 6 years, then that covers, suicide is the leading cause of death in mothers within the first, you know, that postnatal, from 6 weeks to 12 months postnatally. It's a frightening statistic.
Mm.
And while essentially it's not massive numbers that you're dealing with, but very, very important risk factor that needs to be identified and managed. You know, we need to be raising the profile and talking about it. And I don't think you can talk about mum's mental health in isolation, because you know, it's a family unit, so there should be no mum without dad.
Yeah.
In terms of dads, they are more likely to be experiencing, you know, they can experience postnatal depression the same way that mum can. They also, and it's not very well known, but they also have a huge shift in their hormones once the baby's born.
Yeah.
They see a drop in, you know, mainly their testosterone. And I think in terms of evolution, that is so that they are kind of remain in and around the family rather than kind of going out and sowing their wild oats or whatever. They kind of focus it all in terms of bonding and stuff. But certainly where there are maternal mental health concerns, you're more likely to find then that there's a concern with dad, but we don't really ever ask, how are you, dad?
They don't. Yeah. I can see that. And we usually speak to a lot of dads more than the mums. When they call for the prem babies, it's usually the father that needs to find the place to stay. And yeah, they tend to get forgotten. I know.
But that's additional pressure then on the dad or the co-parent, isn't
it? Yeah.
Which must only add to any mental health difficulties they may be experiencing, possibly without even realising that that's what they're experiencing. But definitely in the situation of the families that the Prio Premature Baby Foundation helps, Jo, you guys must see cases where it's quite clear that there's been some trauma.
I'll definitely see a lot of trauma. And like you say, the ones in the flat that have been there a while, you know, they're finding it hard being away from home, and they might have other children that aren't with them. It can get, in some point, they can get really upset. I've just had one recently. They've had to be moved from the flat because Southampton were too busy. They had to go to Salisbury. Upheaval. Okay. They've got another child. Mm. So, yeah, it was a bit upsetting, but everything's been calmed down. But those things don't go away. And like you say, they leave a lasting effect.
Absolutely.
You know, you've had to move and you've got a little baby going to another hospital.
So, and that's, you know, it's managed at the time for what it needs to be. But, you know, I think we probably don't appreciate the gravity of that long-term impact, do we? There's probably not enough done around it. But I think this will be quite a strong collaboration.
I'm so pleased that we can work together on this, because I mean, a lot of people don't, like you say, don't even come back to me and say it's been really hard. But at the time, you know it has. So it'd be nice to be able to say, look, Laura can help out if you need anyone to talk to.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, even with me and Andy, it was the same. He really suffered. And he still thinks about it a lot today. But
and is that when... So
when Seb was born.
When Seb was born, you were living in the UK.
Living in the UK.
By the time Daniela was born, you
come
were
back
in...
to Guernsey.
You were all living in Guernsey, but Andy was away, I remember
He missed the birth. But so
But that in its... That, again...
Doesn't go away.
That's two very different situations. Yeah. In one situation, he was there, able to see it and experience it firsthand. And then in the other situation, he was removed. That must be difficult in a very different way, but equally as challenging.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, he was frightened for me because I wasn't well. So he was so far away. He was like...
He couldn't do anything.
He was in Macau, which was hours away. So he, you know, and that really did stick with him. And again, like you say, they forget that the dads have got a lot to think about.
Yeah.
And look at how, over the course of the last few decades, there is this now expectation that men will be present at the birth of their children, Whereas historically, when it was my granny that was having children, men were nowhere to be found in the pub, you know, waiting for the news. But now we have this expectation that they will be there and they will help, you know, they will be hands-on because, you know, it's all about that kind of mental load. We want them to see what women go through in childbirth. But what do we do then? We just say, oh, we're going to expose you to all of this stuff that's potentially traumatising, life-changing, that's going to affect your mental health, but we're not going to offer you any support about it. So,
yeah,
I think sometimes we've gone too far the other way, and I've been very guilty of it myself with my husband. If ever I heard him say something like, oh yeah, you know, that when Max was born, that was a really challenging time, and I would say, oh, tell me exactly how challenging that was for you, and really minimise how he... And I recognise that now, you know, the more I read around the literature and hear the experiences of other people, and I have been guilty of saying that, you know, because no matter how bad they've had it, we've had it worse.
But in recognising that then, and as you said, reading around it so much, what support are you able to offer now? So this collaboration and your work with Bright Beginnings.
Yes.
What can be done to help people in these situations?
So I think in terms of, first of all, with the collaboration between the Premature Baby Foundation, we recognise that there's a niche group of parents there who... Yeah. You know, they might slip through the gap, would you agree?
Yeah, and you know, sometimes when they go to England, they come back and they're just getting on with their lives, and we might not hear from them again or might not see them again. Sometimes they don't even get to get the baby box because they've just gone off and then they've gone back to their own house. But now we've stopped that. We're trying to find out who needs a baby box. So we're hoping we're going to put a lot of leaflets in there with Laura
and contact details
of how they can help if they need to talk to somebody.
And I think it would be, I think the goal would be essentially that, you know, when you know about them, that you sort of get consent that we can make contact, even if that's just a remote telephone call, video call, text message, just a weekly check-in while they're there, just to make sure that they're okay and advise about sort of self-care techniques, but also to let us know when they're coming back, because we can very much then facilitate lots of different things to support them with their well-being at Bright Beginnings, because there's a wealth of stuff there. You know, there's one-to-one counselling support, there's trauma coaching, there's the support groups, you know, where you have other mums and dads in that same or similar situation, and really helping, because obviously when you've had a sick child that's been in the neonatal unit for whatever reason, whether that's prematurity or you know, some kind of illness or requiring operations, etc., it's very much and I don't know if you agree or disagree, but you know, a lot of those initial cares are done by the special care staff, the doctors, the nurses, and you're not necessarily that hands-on with your baby, because for one, you know, they're probably, you're terrified about infection and bacteria and all those things. And also, they might be in an incubator, they might be needing support with their breathing, they're connected up to lots of tubes and equipment and medications that you know, you don't want to disturb that in any way, shape or form. So you might yourself become a little bit resistant to even want to attempt
to
doing that, because, and obviously then there's that delay. You might not be having the same amount of skin to skin as someone who's been looking after their baby from the minute it was born. And so we can really help to promote that and support the parental well-being and the bond with the baby.
I have known of cases that, you know, the baby's been so tiny, it's taken them months to actually hold the baby. So that bond can take a while if you haven't actually even held the baby. Luckily, I was okay. I remember Danny just gripping my little finger, and that was the end of it. But you know, sometimes you're just whipped away, and you can't actually.
And again, it must come back to, as we said earlier, that then people feel, parents must, in some cases, feel like they should feel grateful. Oh, my baby has been in an incubator for, I don't know, a couple of months maybe, but now I've got my baby, I can hold my baby, and I'm at home with my baby. Everything's fine. I should be grateful for the situation I'm in now. But that trauma is there, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. And probably you become very hypervigilant then.
Yeah.
Because the baby's breathing normal.
Yes.
And you probably become really tense and anxious around the baby's every movement. Mm. And You know, that's normal to experience that. But also, you know, there's ways that we can facilitate that to be an easier transition.
Yeah.
That I think we're missing out on that opportunity to support those parents at the moment. And so, yeah, I think essentially we're a really good, strong collaboration to address an issue that we have here. Because as we were chatting about down the stairs before we came up, that it's, you know, it's not just the parents of the baby that are affected. You know, you might have, there are a lot of blended families now, so this might be a new relationship and they've had a baby together, but we can't forget about the existing children from previous relationships and actually what are the situations around the partners, the ex-partners and the children there. How does that affect it? But also the financial repercussions. Because
That comes up a lot.
If you have a partner that's then off island with a baby, what is the paternity leave like in Guernsey? You know, it's not very generous. My husband didn't. He used 2 days annual leave, I think, and then was back to work on the Monday. So very quickly, you might see that dad or the partner has to come back to the island to get back to work very quickly, and then is probably using that week's wage to go and visit his partner and the baby. You know, it has a much wider impact than we appreciate. And obviously, that's just kind of from the outside looking in. And it probably feels really awful for those families at that time. It kind of just throws everything up in the air, doesn't it?
It does. So
the support that's being offered then through Bright Beginnings and now in the collaboration with the PBBF, is this new? Has anyone done this kind of support over here before?
It's new, I think-ish, with you, isn't it? You brought this to the island,
I'd
say.
The perinatal mental health support has been kind of sat through Bright Beginnings for some time, obviously, since the, I think, 7 or 8 years since it was initially founded. And Rachel Copeland, the director there, is very passionate about, you know, offering support to families. And I guess while I was a clinical midwife for a long time, my passion always lay with perinatal mental health through my own lived experiences.
Yes.
So I have 3 children. My eldest will soon be 15, and then I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. My daughter has some significant learning disabilities, epilepsy, autism, ADHD, a variety of things, and she goes to a special needs school. And I, on reflection, think that the experiences that I have had throughout healthcare with my daughter, she's had a lot of kind of medical trauma in her life. Just, you know, by, she doesn't want to do something, but we need to explore it, and
that, it's frightening for her.
Yeah, it's really frightening for her. And I think then that probably fed into, you know, when I then was having the boys, that I didn't want to leave her with anyone, not even my own mum. So when I went in to have my son Max, I was in the UK at the time, she had a seizure on, so my son Max was born on Boxing Day, and Jodie had quite a big seizure on Christmas Day night. After all of the excitement, so we were blue lighted into hospital, and I actually asked if we could just be discharged because I was quite heavily pregnant and I could feel that there was a shift beginning to happen, and I thought, we need to get home because I don't need to be in labour on the children's ward. I'm sure that's the last thing that they need. And a few hours later then my waters broke and subsequently went into labour. But I was very quick to be discharged because I couldn't stay in the hospital. I was desperate to get home to her, to care for her needs. And then I had my son Lewis in Guernsey, and while it was all very straightforward, there were some medical complications with myself. I had a heart condition that I hadn't discovered until, you know, part way through the pregnancy. I had gestational diabetes, I had my daughter at home, I had my 2.5-year-old at home. And by this point, we're not surrounded by lots of family on an island because we'd moved away from family by then. So, you know, the support network is different. I don't have my mum around me. I don't have sister, aunties, best friends. And don't get me wrong, I was well supported by what I would call the family on Loveridge Ward, all the lovely midwives and friends that I had through work, but it was a very fast delivery and I was really traumatised by the end of it. I remember I didn't want to leave the house for at least the first kind of 4 or 5 weeks. My husband didn't have much time off work, and that meant obviously I was having to go straight back into school drop-off, school pick-ups, and manage that whole load without the support network that I had with the previous kids.
Yeah.
But the, you know, the existing issues that my daughter had still remained. And I had some significant postnatal issues, felt suicidal. But I had therapy for that, talking therapies, and then I was referred into for some EMDR therapy, which is the kind of gold standard treatment for PTSD. And, you know, that was great and it resolved a lot of my issues. But, you know, I could see very clearly how, you know, if this is how I feel as a midwife within that kind of context of childbirth, you know, from the other side, how actually that people with more complex lives, more complex issues, more terrifying situations with sick babies, really poorly mum, how that must impact people. So then that's kind of what led me to start my extended study, because, you know, I wasn't busy enough. I thought, like,
but you obviously saw that there was maybe not a need, but you knew from your lived experience that this was an area that you wanted to explore, and now you, through that extended period of study, you can now help other people.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. So I'll be due to graduate from that master's towards the end of this year.
Oh, right.
If I put my finger out and write. I've been telling myself that the deadline is May. It's actually August. I wish I hadn't figured that out, because for a long time I thought it was May. Oh. And then I thought, I wonder what date it is in May. Oh, it's actually August. So
you're giving yourself a couple of
weeks. I know, I keep telling myself May, make sure it's done for me. As part of that study, which has been through Sheffield Hallam University, the dissertation, I've been able to do some research on the executive function experiences of postnatal women with ADHD, because aside from, you know, all the things that I've talked about, a big part of why I'm not working clinically anymore is because I had a diagnosis of ADHD over a year ago now. And that, for me, answered a lot of outstanding questions throughout my entire existence, really. I know a lot of people don't like to talk about labels, but actually it was more than a label for me. It was a lifesaver. Because now on reflection, everything makes sense. You know, it didn't happen overnight, but you gradually kind of process things throughout the course of your life and understand yourself much better.
Yeah.
And it's as if I've just been using the wrong handbook all my life, and now I've got the right one. It just, you know, it's opened my mind to so many different things. And so that's the thing about neurodivergent people are probably more vulnerable within maternity services in terms of mental health, physical health and birth trauma than we know, because there's not a whole lot of research around it.
That's interesting.
And in terms of helping people then, so you've got to get your thesis written.
Yes!
You've graduated later this year. You're going to be getting extra busy then, because people are going to know about this support services that are available. But how are people finding out about it at the moment? So you mentioned before leaflets in the baby boxes.
Leaflets, and just sitting
I'm guessing
up
through the maternity services at the hospital.
Yes, so people
and
can...
Bright Beginnings,
yeah, so people can refer in to Bright Beginnings. It can be a self-referral. It can be through the GP. It can be through, obviously, the Premature Baby Foundation. You know, anybody at all, you just have to go into the Bright Beginnings.
It's just good it's been spoken about.
Website, and that,
which is what I think is the main thing. I was also thinking while I'm sitting here, like the flats in Southampton, I should have your link there, because they're the ones that feel alone. For me, they do, because they're not here with their families, like you said. So that would be a good idea to do that.
Absolutely.
Link everybody there.
Absolutely.
because we don't always know who the patients are. It's usually, like you say, from the neonatal unit straight there. I don't really get to know them unless they text me, which we try to get like a bond going, but sometimes they're very private. They could only be there a week and then they've gone. Yeah. But you don't know they've been traumatised in that week, you don't know. So
And that's the thing, you know, when it's when you're thinking about in terms of premature birth, that comes as a complete shock to the system.
Yeah.
Physically, mentally, no bad emotionally. Pat. You know, you're just not expecting it at all, and it might just completely have come out of the blue.
Mm.
So you have that, and then obviously the baby is then probably taken very quickly following delivery into the neonatal unit, so you're kind of left thinking, what?
Where's my baby?
What has just happened to me? Where is my baby?
Yeah.
For them then to have to be transferred off island because maybe they're, you know, just too young to be cared for in Guernsey. They might need more specialist care. And that whole transfer situation is really scary. I mean, it's scary for the staff that on those little tiny the little medevac airplanes.
That must be scary, that.
So it must be terrifying for you know, the parents and the baby to then have to go to a hospital where you don't know anyone and kind of try and settle down in there.
Yeah.
And then any of the medical complications, you know, just the whole step by step, it's blow after blow after blow that, you know, you just...
And the frustration when they're feeding as well. I always remember with Seb, it was one millimetre an hour. It was like painstaking, you know. Can't feed him now. It was really hard.
And of course, people, you might have had, in all your antenatal planning, you might have had your heart set on breastfeeding.
That didn't happen.
And then that's another thing, because you just keep thinking, God, but I really wanted to be able to... So you kind of grieve almost for the...
Because your milk hasn't come in and everything,
there's a whole host of complications, isn't there?
I'm getting traumatised now thinking about
it. Well, this is the thing, and it's long-lasting, isn't it?
It's long-lasting,
and it's those memories, I guess, being sparked by conversations years down the line, and you then realise, oh, actually...
And that's the thing about trauma, isn't it? That you don't know, really, you're traumatised until it smacks you in the face 12 years later in the supermarket and you're left in floods of tears.
So for people who want... to reach out at the moment, what's the best way to do that and who should they contact directly?
They should come through to you.
If you have a look on the Bright Beginnings website, there is a link to a referral form. You just need to fill that form in, and the team have set up a kind of really swift, smooth process where one of us will pick up that email and we aim to make contact within 48 hours so that, you know, there's not massively long waits, because when you need help and normally it's taken people a while to ask for it, to recognise that they need it, and it's really difficult to ask for help, so
you don't want to ignore it, do you?
So Teresa, Amy, Lizzie, Faye and I in the office, you know, we'll very quickly try and make contact just to make sure that person is okay, just take a very brief history and make sure that they're safe, and we then will take that referral. We have a Monday morning meeting where we have a look at all the referrals that have come in over the previous week, and we discuss them and we try and work out who would be the best person to support them going forward, and then that, once that key person, so family wellness practitioners, they will be assigned a person who will then contact and go into things a little bit more detail, and then we'll meet up and explore a sort of bespoke support package, if you like, that you know, we'll explain all of this, the range of support options that we have, and kind of build that around to suit them. And that might just be, you know, a weekly cup of tea and a chat to see how the previous week has been, and, you know, obviously following, because we have women coming to see us from antenatal, post-birth, we can do like a birth debrief, just to chat through, you know, how they've been left feeling since they've delivered. And a lot of people have asked, do I need to bring my notes for this? And actually I'm very anti having the notes, because the notes are a kind of factual black and white account of a series of events that have happened during childbirth from the healthcare professional's perspective. What it doesn't give is how the woman and her partner have perceived it, and that's completely out with, you know, that's out with the control of the healthcare professionals. And it's designed to be sort of emotionless. It needs to be a factual account because it's a legal document. And so I'm only interested to then hear, well, tell me about it. Why? Let me understand why you've been left feeling this way. Like, did you feel frightened, etc.? And then we just try and kind of work through, work through those things.
And these talking therapies are so, can be so successful, can't they?
Oh yeah,
hugely. They're so important.
And also though, the I think the value of that peer support as well. You know, if they're coming to support groups, shared experiences to know that you're not alone. And so a lot of that is facilitated, particularly by Amy, Teresa and Lizzie. You know, they have the Mum's Comfort Zone, which is just a lovely group, and they eat a cup of tea, a bit of cake, and just a really nice kind of guided conversation, working on self-care techniques and stuff. We've all now done the Decider Skills training as well, so that we can, you know, we can look at that self-regulation when people are at home, and then hopefully be able to teach some of those skills then onto their children as their children grow. So, you know, it's it's been a really enjoyable job so far. Very grateful to be there. And in terms of fathers' mental health, you know, the fathers are more than welcome to come and access any of the support there. But I understand that it's a difficult, they're difficult to reach sometimes because they might not recognise, for one, that they are struggling with their mental health, and number two, they might not want to speak to anybody about it, maybe particularly a woman, I don't know. So, yeah, I think we're kind of working on that in the background to see how we can better support male mental health locally. And
might be worth getting a man on board to help with that.
So, aside from the birth trauma work, I am collaborating with someone called Mark Williams, who is an international father's mental health campaigner.
Okay.
He is Welsh, and he has a very strong lived experience of postnatal depression from his wife, but also from his perspective. His son is 20 years old now, and his wife experienced some really severe postnatal depression, and as a result then he had to take some time off work following that birth to, you know, care and support his wife. But detrimental to his own mental health. So by the time his wife was beginning to recover, his mental health was taking a bit of a nosedive. So he's now made it his life's mission to support men in their mental health. And, you know, he's done a lot of different campaigns, one of them being the How Are You Dad campaign. And, you know, he does a lot of work within his own community, but also internationally. He's done an international keynote speaker. He's written lots of books and stuff. So
That'd be good to link for that.
Hopefully, I can kind of link him in with the whole kind of network in Guernsey, and he can advise us and support how we approach fathers' mental health going forward.
Because that support network is there and it's growing, and it will only continue to grow then through this collaboration and through your work and through people like Mark, who you're bringing in as well.
I've always wanted to, with the charity, to go that next step. So it was really interesting bumping into Laura and helping out with the parents, because, you know, it's okay giving a baby box and getting the flats, but there's more there to it. So it's been wonderful to collab with the Bright Beginnings. And hopefully it's going to be a success and we can help lots of people.
We have blossoming friendship.
You've been listening to a Bailiwick Express podcast. If you like what you heard, please share, like and subscribe so we at Bailiwick can continue to pull apart the stories that affect you, the listener. Thank you for joining us.